lowest time. And it's time we step up and say, let's be Alaskans again. Let's be more aggressive on this issue.
Alaska leaders criticized the Obama administration's decision to cancel Arctic Ocean lease sales. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, October 16th. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, a baffling ice plug shuts down an essential well for Bethel schools.
I had hoped, hope upon hope, that we would have already been through it, but we're not. I have no idea how deep this plug can go.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
The Obama administration announced today that it is canceling plans to open up more of the Arctic Ocean to oil and gas drilling, citing not enough industry interest in the region. Alaska Public Media's Rachel Waldholtz reports.
The Interior Department won't auction off drilling rights in the Chukchi and Beaufort Seas in the next 2 years. The auctions would have been the first in the Arctic Ocean since 2008 and the first under President Obama. The announcement comes just weeks after Shell suspended its controversial quest to drill in the Arctic Ocean after disappointing results this summer. The department also rejected requests from Shell and from the Norwegian company Statoil to extend their leases in the region, which will expire by 2020. Governor Bill Walker reacted to the news with frustration.
And as we struggle with funding on education, cost of energy, I can't tell you how disappointed I am in this decision.
The Walker administration had high hopes for offshore drilling at a time when plunging oil prices and declining production have decimated state revenues. Walker says it's like that door has been shut in Alaska's face and says he'll work with the congressional delegation to formulate a response.
This hits us at our lowest time, and it's time we step up and say, let's be Alaskans again. Let's be more aggressive on this issue.
But the Interior Department says there simply isn't enough industry interest to justify the lease sales. At least 9 companies already hold more than 500 active leases in U.S. portions of the Arctic Ocean. But since Shell pulled out, there's only one nearshore project under development, Hilcorp's Liberty Unit. In a written statement, Interior Secretary Sally Jewell cited Shell's decision, the amount of acreage already leased, and current market conditions as reasons to hold off on sales for at least the next year and a half. The Interior Department has not ruled out future lease sales after 2017. And the department said Shell and Statoil had not laid out specific plans for exploration under their existing leases, a requirement for extending them. But that didn't stop Alaska's elected officials from expressing outrage. Speaking with reporters at the Alaska Federation of Natives Convention in Anchorage, Congressman Don Young said he has a plan. Step one is a lawsuit. Step two is essentially siphon the Fed's oil tank.
We ought to go right up next to Anwar and go off 3 miles offshore. We'll rent a rig. Okay, we got a couple around here. Okay, we'll peel them around, and we'll drill on state land and run the doggone horizontal drilling out 15 miles, which is possible, and we'll take their oil. See how long that'll last. That's my idea. It's a positive step forward.
Governor Walker suggests that's an idea that's occurred to him, too.
You been reading my email, buddy?
From the Energy Desk, with help from Liz Ruskin and Daisha Eaton, I'm Rachel Waldholtz.
Every year, Alaska's congressional delegation is invited to address the AFN convention, and today was U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski's turn. She stuck close to the theme of the convention, heroes in our homeland, but as APRN's Liz Ruskin reports, she did mention a few of her own accomplishments.
Like Senator Dan Sullivan did, Murkowski kept her speech focused on Alaska Native heroes. But while he mostly discussed military veterans, Murkowski put more emphasis on the civic and cultural leaders. She reeled off scores of names: Sidney Huntington, John Baker, Pauline Carlow, Georgiana Lincoln, Rosita Worrell. Murkowski recognized leaders in community health, suicide prevention, education, and one pair of exemplary parents.
These are heroes, each and every day making a difference. One person saying, I can do something to change the direction.
Murkowski also endorsed a passionate cause permeating this year's convention.
My list of heroes includes friends in the interior and across the state who seek justice for the Fairbanks Four. We will continue with that.
During her speech, a dozen or so demonstrators came in, some in animal costumes. They held subsistence and climate-related signs like, "Don't roll the dice with my ice," and "Ichthyophonus is upon us." That's a fish parasite. They were soon asked to leave. Murkowski did highlight some of her work in the Senate, including a provision in a bill that would require school districts and the state to give more deference to Native communities. And she talked about her support of a bill to restore the Voting Rights Act. With help from Daisha Eaton in Anchorage, I'm Liz Ruskin in Washington.
One of the protesters in costume during Senator Murkowski's speech was George Pletnikoff Jr., originally from St. Paul Island, now living in Palmer.
So we are here to make a statement that Lisa Murkowski needs to address our demands that we refuse fossil fuel use as continuing it. No drilling in the Arctic, no drilling in the National Wildlife Refuge, that we must switch towards renewable energies and create a sustainable future.
Pletnikoff says the protest was organized by members of Alaska's Rising Tide, Red Oil, or Resisting Environmental Destruction on Indigenous Lands. Murkowski says she didn't hear or see the protest, but she defended her record, saying she's working to support renewable energy along with fossil fuel development. A disproportionately high number of Alaska Natives are incarcerated in the state of Alaska. Recidivism rates are higher for that group as well. Now the state is working on new ways to partner with tribes to help solve both problems. KSKA's urban affairs reporter Ann Hillman learned more.
For the first time in Alaska, there will be a joint tribal-state court. A Kainai judge will sit side by side with a state judge and have equal say in decisions. It will be a wellness court that hears criminal cases involving substance abuse and will start taking up to 20 participants in March. Currently, tribal courts only have jurisdiction over civil matters like adoptions, divorces, domestic violence petitions, and child protection cases. Kainai Chief Judge Kimberly Sweet will be one of the two judges who preside over the court. She says it will be run like most tribal courts.
We don't wear robes. We have a big conference table. Everybody sits around the conference table. Parties are allowed to seek legal counsel. They can bring their legal counsel to court with them, and legal counsel is allowed to advise them, but we do not speak to their legal counsel. We hear directly from the parties themselves.
Sweet says the process helps get to and treat the root of the problem. Program developers are currently working on a handbook of the procedures so the model can be repeated throughout the state.
Not just based on personalities of people that have, you know, with big hearts that are driving this, so that it actually becomes institutionalized and can be picked up and taken by anybody.
Similar joint courts already exist in Minnesota and California. A 2014 change in court rules also allows the state's court system to use collaborative methods for sentencing adults, like circle sentencing. The Kainai tribe and others are already using the method with juvenile offenders. Sweet explains that circle sentencing brings the offender, community members, family members, and sometimes the victim into the same room to discuss the issue and the solution.
Nobody is an authority in the circle. The circle collaborates and works together as a little mini community to come up with a plan to put that youth or that adult back on a good path with as much input from the youth or the adult as possible.
For adult cases, the state judge would make the final sentencing decision. The state is also working on a plan to improve the outcomes for Alaska Natives who end up incarcerated. The Department of Corrections is convening an Alaska Native focus group for reducing recidivism. Alaska's recidivism rate is 63% for everyone leaving the prison system. For Alaska Natives, it's 74%. DOC Commissioner Ron Taylor discussed the formation of the group during AFN.
We're concerned about the higher rate of recidivism among that group and looking for ways to improve those outcomes. How do we do a better job of providing programming and resources? How do we do a better job of linking them to services once they get released? And how do we do a better job also of ensuring that they're going back to their communities if they choose to do so?
The group will be chaired by Lieutenant Governor Byron Malott and meet for the first time next week in Anchorage. From the Urban Affairs Desk, I'm Ann Hillman.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a Smithsonian exhibit highlights the dying art of dugout canoe.
We're in a desperate time right now, trying to keep that art alive.
Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. And by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
The first of four Fairbanks men seeking exoneration from convictions for a 1997 murder took the stand at an ongoing evidentiary hearing yesterday. George Freese testified that he drank excessively the night 15-year-old John Hartman was found fatally beaten on a downtown street. Freese said alcohol-induced blackouts obliterated his memory of much of the October evening and early morning, and that during subsequent hours of police questioning, he caved to accusations that he, Marvin Roberts, Kevin Pease, and Eugene Vent must have attacked Hartman.
Just tired of being there, and I knew. I kept telling them that I don't remember, that I don't know, and everything. And I just tried to minimize my involvement in whatever they were throwing at me. They're telling me that Eugene puts me there, that Kevin started it, that and that I was there. Well, I must have kicked him. So I just agreed to that. And they asked me about Marvin a couple times after that, and I'm saying, I don't know. And then they say, Marvin was driving, yes? And I said, yeah, sure, whatever you want.
Freese, who later recanted his confession, says he does not know how he sustained a foot injury the night Hartman was kicked to death. Under questioning from State Attorney Adrian Bachman, Freese admitted that his heavy drinking sometimes led to fights.
Did you always fight with friends, or did you sometimes fight with strangers?
I've never went and fought strangers, no. I've never went out preying on random people, ever.
Freese was overcome by emotion at one point during his testimony, yelling that police had incessantly accused him of something he did not do. The breakdown triggered Judge Paul Lyle to call a brief recess. When the hearing resumed, Fairbanks' four supporters stood in solidarity with hands raised, holding four fingers in the air. Judge Lyle admonished the gallery to refrain from protests in the courtroom. Jason Wallace will testify at the Fairbanks 4 hearing later in the month. Wallace is a former Fairbanks resident serving life in prison for an unrelated murder who in 2003 confidential comments to a public defender's agency employee implicated himself and a group of others, not the Fairbanks Four, in the Hartman attack. Wallace will testify as a state witness live in court. In a small claims case between a trapper and a trap springer, a judge finds the trap springer liable but doesn't award any damages to the trapper. Trapper John Forrest sued hiker Kathleen Turley for springing his lawfully set traps on Davies Creek Trail in Juneau. Turley had made headlines in January for also freeing a bald eagle from two traps. KTOO's Lisa Fu has more.
In his decision, Judge Thomas Nave addresses each trap Kathleen Turley admitted to springing last December. Nave writes that Turley was justified in springing the Martin trap closest to the unintentionally caught eagle she was freeing. Regarding the other trap near the trailhead that she sprung twice over 2 days, the judge doesn't find Turley justified. In her concern for dogs and other hikers, Nave writes, other alternatives existed. Even though Nave finds Turley liable, he states John Forrest failed to prove his damages during the small claims case that took place over 2 days. Forrest had testified he was owed up to $750, but Nave writes he offered no evidence, like a weekly log of what animals he traps. Forrest's lawyer, Zane Wilson, asked for an additional $500 in punitive damages. That was denied as well because he didn't prove Turley sprang the traps out of malice. Turley sees the decision as a win-win. She's relieved she doesn't have to pay anything toward what started out as a $5,000 complaint. And she hopes it'll make Forrest and other trappers happy.
They wanted to make a point that it's not okay to spring people's traps. And they've made that point because they won as far as that goes. And for me, it was more important that I didn't have to pay anything.
Neither Forrest nor his attorney, Zane Wilson, returned calls for comment. Pete Buest, a spokesman for the Alaska Trappers Association, is pleased with the decision.
As a trapper, as a guy who, you know, occasionally speaks for trappers, I think it's pretty good.
Buest says it's unfortunate Forrest didn't get an award for damages, but he calls the decision fair. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
An ice chunk is blocking an essential well for Bethel schools. For almost a week, maintenance crews have been melting the ice while the city delivers water to the campus. So far, there's no end in sight to how deep the impasse runs. KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur has the story.
Every school in Bethel relies on the frozen well. When it's working, the well provides water for the Yupik Immersion School, the Kuskokwim Learning Academy, and student dorms. The three other schools in Bethel receive its food from the Kuskokwim Learning Academy kitchen.
That school is a main artery here.
James Mikesell is the plant facilities manager for the Lower Kuskokwim School District. He's leading the charge on the frozen well, which started showing problems in September.
It was slowing down. Its production level was slowing down. And then as of 9/28, that was it. There was just hardly any water coming out at all.
Mikesell first thought the well had collapsed. The structure's pipe was installed in the 1960s and has been sitting in earth rich in iron, which corrodes metal.
We put some heat down there with some heat tape and melted. It started going down. And I'm going, well, sand doesn't do that. Solid ground doesn't do that.
Then he discovered something he'd never seen before, never even heard of before.
We've come to find out that it is frozen.
Mikesell and his crew have been melting a tube of ice inside the well casing for about a week. So far, they've thawed 30 feet of ice.
It was 8 feet one day. It was 3 feet another day. It was 5 feet another day.
The ice initially started about 100 feet below ground. Mikesell says the deeper they go, the slower it melts.
I had hope upon hope, that we would have already been through it, but we're not. I have no idea how deep this plug can go.
The well runs almost 450 feet. The school district has ordered another heating device that's supposed to blast out the ice with hot water, hopefully.
These are just kind of experiments in terror when it comes to this sort of thing.
While Mikesell and his crew work on the well, the school district is purchasing hauled water from the city, almost 7,000 gallons per day, $100 a day. In Bethel, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
Linfield College in Oregon offers degrees in the arts, sciences, and professional programs, and a rich campus life with athletics, music, study abroad, and more. Learn more about Linfield at the Anchorage College Fair on Sunday, October 18th, or at linfield.edu. This message sponsored by Linfield College.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Monica Goki. This week on AK, Ocean Canoe. Tlingit Master Carver Wayne Price has a relationship with the ocean and the tides that runs deeper than most. He carves dugout canoes in Haines, and his work and words are set to hit the road this spring as a part of the Smithsonian's Waterways exhibit. It's a traveling show from the Smithsonian Institution's Museum on Main Street, designed for rural museums. KHNS's Jillian Rogers spent time with Price in his studio and has this story.
Wayne Price is standing in his home studio explaining the maze of lines on his wood floor. He uses the lines to measure the canoe he's working on. His dugout canoes are big, about 30 feet long and heavy.
And this is a scaled model of a northern dugout canoe. And I had to do this half model in order for me to get loft the measurements off of this.
The visitor is Smithsonian Curatorial Assistant Tiffany Chang. Chang found Price while looking for an Alaskan for the Waterways Project through the Sea Alaska Heritage Institute. Price says he was happy to get involved mostly as a chance to help revive his art form, which he says is dying.
And the dugout canoes have been a big part of that all through 10,000 years of history. And we're in a desperate time right now trying to keep that art alive.
Once Chang arrived in Haines, she hopped on a local fishing boat with her cameraman to get some shots of Price and his crew paddling one of his prized canoes. Chang says Price was an obvious choice for the project.
I wanted to meet him and talk to him about the craft of dugout canoes and the tradition and the connection, the cultural connection to the water here in Alaska.
Besides Price and his canoes, the project includes a crabber in Louisiana, a shrimp boat captain in Mississippi, and a conservationist who works in the Florida Everglades. The project is a window into people's lives and a reflection of what water means to them.
And the goal is not for us to tell the story, it's for them to say it for themselves. So that's our goal for coming out and meeting people like Wayne and hearing from them directly, instead of just text on a wall or out of a book.
On her last day in Haines, Chang was treated to a private singing and drumming performance by Price, Ted Hart, and Zachary James. Price, sharing his passion comes easily. He enjoys teaching young people in the region how to carve and the significance of dugout canoes. And, he says, taking part in the Waterways Project is another good way to spread the word about what he refers to as an endangered art. He says the canoes are one more way to foster traditional values.
Well, the Tlingit people come from the water. They're people of the tide. We've always said when the tide goes out, it's time to go to eat. We gather all our food from the beach or the woods inside the beach, and that our whole way of living has been on the water and with the tides.
The fact that interest in this specialized craft is waning is simply a sign of the times, but local people are getting more involved these days, he says, and taking an interest in learning the trade. The Waterways exhibition will launch in May 2016 in Florida, Idaho, and Illinois first. The project will then travel to various small towns across the U.S. for 6 years. In Haines, I'm Jillian Rogers.
Now it's time for 49 Voices. This week, we're at the Alaska Federation of Natives Convention talking with Martin Lee Woods from Kotzebue. He started learning to Eskimo dance in 1975, and by the mid-80s, he realized he needed to learn how to make drums.
In 86, many of our elders were passing away, so we needed new drums. And by that time, I wasn't really taught how to make drums by the elders I learned to Eskimo dance from. So what I had to do was go around town and look at the surviving elders' drums. And I looked them up and down and sideways to see how they were made or what must be done to make a drum look like theirs. And I think some of them were made from birch driftwood. Otherwise, you'd also, they tell me you have to find a birch with a natural curve in it. I had learned to work with ash hardwood and hickory, bending hickory hardwood from a white man in a woodshop class in high school in ninth grade, 1975, who was from somewhere in the States. But I saw how he used a primer stove, Coleman stove, two burner, with a metal can to boil water and a 5-inch stovepipe over the can to capture the steam. So in 86, when they all started passing away and they didn't show us really how to do that, I remembered how he did that, and I took a 55-gallon tank, cut open the top, and using C-clamps and the Coleman stove and the metal can and the stove pipes, I got some hardwood from the lumber yard, cut them into strips, and got them to the rough dimensions. And the leftover from cutting that used for the stick to beat the drum. And I soaked the wood, bend it around the tank, using the C-clamps to hold it on the tank. And the two ends are held together by a small piece, round, halfway rounded, using Elmer's wood glue I bought from Napa. And that's how I learned to make a drum. So it's a combination of looking at the elders' drum before they passed away, and then using technology and skills learned from my ninth grade teacher, who was a white man.
Martin Lee Woods lives in Kotzebue. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. If you want to tell your story, send an email to news@alaskapublic.org. Thanks for listening to AK. We had help this week from Ann Hillman, Annie Feit, and Dave Waldron. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Monica Gokey.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Rachel Waldholtz, Ann Hillman and Daisha Eaton in Anchorage, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Lisa Fu in Juneau, and Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Gokey is our web editor. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Raven Alaska, providing business travel needs in over 100 communities across the state. Find more at flyraven.com. And by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. Alaska oil and gas have a huge impact on all of us, but how much do you really know about them? At akoilandgas.com, you can take an oil and gas IQ quiz and get the facts from reliable sources. This message sponsored by the Alaska Oil and Gas Association. Learn more about Alaska Pacific University during a 3-day weekend experience October 30th to November 1st. Experience the campus and Anchorage while discovering how APU can map out your educational adventure by attending courses, participating in activities, and interacting with faculty and other students. Register at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.